Very good afternoon. Welcome to the Kurang Manis, Sugarless, Help! I'm Pre-Diabetic podcast. I'm Jasmine Low, and right beside me is Nikki Yeo. Nikki Yeo is my fitness trainer, my coach, and my co-founder. She's also the one who reminds me what I'm putting into my mouth could be my medicine or could be working against me. Today we have a very special guest, Teresa Liu. We call her Therese. Born in Malaysia, she graduated as a pharmacist in New Zealand and then gained experience in the UK before moving to Australia. Teresa Liu is the eldest of three girls, and she's enjoyed a diverse career in pharmacy in the community, hospital, and education fields. Her passion lies in preventative medicine, having had contact with so many patients with complications from chronic disease. It was heart-wrenching for her to see them go through the journey. So she thought she could make more of an impact in early intervention to prevent the complications of chronic disease. Therese focuses on type 2 diabetes. Could it be because both her grandfathers suffered from the complications of type 2 diabetes? So she's going to be joining us today to share why she's all in to prevent and keep diabetes in remission. On a side note, her husband and her have three chickens, Snap, Crackle, and Pop, and enjoy being part of the self-sufficient community in Brisbane. Good day, Therese.
Hi, Jasmine. Hi, Nikki. How's it going?
Very good.
I think my chickens
I
will be very
love.
excited to be, mentioned in a podcast.
I love that poster behind you. For listeners, if they can imagine what is that poster behind you, it's just like a really amazing snapshot. Therese, can you share what's behind you? What's that poster?
So, the picture behind is actually completed by Dr. Louise Phillips. So she's a GP that specializes in low carb and also diabetes. The theme of it is sugary feet. So it's a play on words and how there's all the elements that contribute to diabetes. So there's the tent there where the cost of entry to see the doctor whilst enjoying life in the fun fair. So we've got cravings and weight control and all sorts of sugary treats that tempt you, that you might end up in the tent. But if you eat nourishing foods and beverages, you might be able to actually get out of the tent.
That is so cool. The tent is the last place. Actually, the tent is never the place. So you have like
Agree.
this picture of like a green grass, village, happy people, and unassuming, right? This whatever that's under the tent. It's just like us in a supermarket.
Everything looks hunky-dory on the outside, but diabetes is a very insidious and it creeps and creeps and creeps, and then you don't realize it until you slept with the diagnosis.
That's pretty cool. I think in your case, my case, not so much Nikki's case, we've got family with history of type 2 diabetes. I was just wondering if you have any peranakan blood in your family history.
I've asked my dad a couple of times because I love the Nyonya food. I've got relatives in Penang and Klang, and so a lot of the foods that we eat have a bit of that background. Because one of the things I quiz my dad is because my great grandmother, she lived till 98 years old, and I always wondered, no, she didn't have diabetes. In those days, they were quite poor. My dad's one of eight, so they were always on a budget-friendly diet. And so she cooked things like squid and lemongrass soup with assam, and also things like the pineapple sambal, like pineapple that's been crushed and added with some like dried prawns and some spices. So I believe like there is a bit of a Nyonya sort of theme to the food, but I don't know whether I've got any Peranakan blood.
The reason why I ask is because it seems like the most delicious foods come from places that are so rich in culture. And as a place that is so rich in culture, the layers also adds on. So in a typical Peranakan diet, you will find that they're eating lots of santan, which is coconut milk. And then it's slathered with like gula melaka, which is brown sugar. It's just so rich, so delicious. And perhaps it's symbolic also of the hardships that the ancestors have gone through. And the modern day, you know, descendants are now enjoying the spoils.
Yes, I love my Nyonya food, and I've tried the different diets, and I find that I still go back to what I grew up with. I don't know whether you and Nikki, like you both have lived overseas, and you know what sort of foods you actually favor nowadays. Did y'all grow up with having supper, like, so after dinner, like, did your parents say, oh, do you guys feel like supper? And then like 9 o'clock, yeah, you might go to the hawker stalls. So that was the biggest change moving from Malaysia to New Zealand, Australia, that none of the shops open beyond 7 o'clock sometimes, or 8 o'clock or 9 o'clock. And I think the 24/7 eating frenzy in Malaysia, it's sort of like the, not just the qualities of the lemak and everything else, it's the quantity. And when we talk a little bit, there's so much more information about intermittent fasting and ways we can actually give our body a break.
I totally agree with you, because if we think about the hunter-gatherer would only eat when the sun is up, and when it gets dark, it's time for them to just retire and rest and hide away. Therese, you're a pharmacist. Your experience spans three continents, and you've chosen to help patients with this particular NCD, right? Besides the impetus, you know, from your background, is there any other reason why you think this is an important area to focus on?
There's nothing like skin in the game. And with my family history, because my both, as you alluded, now Jasmine, both my grandfathers, they suffered the complications of type 2 diabetes. So on my father's side, my gong, he developed like a stroke, and you know, he was left paralyzed, and he had to go into care. Very, very sad to see your loved ones going through that state. And my mother's side, you know, he developed a serious infection that required his leg to be amputated, and my aunt was taking good care of him. She was a registered nurse, and from a paper cut, because of the severity of having too much sugar in the blood, it was so severe that the only outcome was to actually remove the limb. So my maternal grandfather, he used to cycle around. He would play, you know, he used to be a badminton sort of champion when he was younger. So it would have been heartbreaking to have to go through that and be immobilized and lose independence. So I think it's made me think, you know, now with all the information that we have, we know that this condition, you know, you can control it, and you have the power if you choose to. And if the people, you know, have the, you know, same information I have now, if my grandparents had the same information that I had, I think their lives would have been different. And what set me about this is when I was visiting GPs as part of the academic detailing program. So with the National Prescribing Service, we provided education to GPs, pharmacists, nurses, health professionals, and we did diabetes. And one of the permanent marks of it was this trial, like, called the Diabetes Prevention Program, and it was set in people with pre-diabetes, and they compared like the main medication for type 2 diabetes, metformin, versus diet and lifestyle. And they found that with diet and lifestyle, it was a 58%, you know, reduction in the incidence of type 2 diabetes versus 31% with metformin. It was a game changer in that diet and lifestyle was actually more effective than one of the first line treatments for diabetes. So armed with that and my sort of personal background, I always had this thinking that perhaps there was more to it, that, you know, with the diabetes, instead of the usual sort of progression that, okay, from type 2 diabetes, you start medications and then you get on insulin, and, you know, you get, that's going to prevent the blindness and anything else that's, you know, from complications of type 2 diabetes. That's that usual pathway that the patients are told that once you actually been diagnosed with type 2 diabetes, that your life's going to change forever and it's not going to get any better. You start off with oral medications and then you need to have the injectables and then you get to be on insulin. And that's all just to prevent, you know, you from losing your eyes. You want to prevent blindness, any of the small vessel conditions, you want to protect your kidneys, etc. But with this study, it showed that you could actually reduce the incidence of diabetes by 58% significantly. And so the cogs were in motion. And when I read the book Life Without Diabetes by Professor Roy Taylor, he's a professor of medicine and metabolism. So metabolism is a study of how things are broken down to provide energy to the body, so foods we eat, etc. And he developed a technology with an MRI, magnetic resonance imaging, it's like scan where you can actually look at the fat amount in the body as well. And from his study, he found that, you know, if you eat too much carbs, proteins or fat, it gets stored as fat, which is quite simple, but it was game changing for me as well. No, the DEXA scan is really good for finding your bone density and you know where the cracks are. But this one here, he developed this MRI scan where you can look at the fat content of the internal organs. So it was, you know, it was quite mind blowing to have this visual that you. So he did a study, the direct study, DIRECT, and he got patients, before and after, and all he did was 7% weight loss. And within the first week, the MRI, because that's how they actually monitor the progression, they found that within a week, a high percentage of the fat had reduced. So weight loss can reduce the fat. And the issue is when that's there's amazing. Fat in the wrong places, like your vital organs, like your liver, when it's not meant to be there, the inflammation attracts a lot of chemicals and you get scarring and you get, when you've got a liver cell that's meant to be healthy and now it's scarred, it can't function. And then you get non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. And if you've got more and more scarring and your liver can't function, it becomes, you know, liver cancer. And what I've learned is that anything, you know, it's a continuum, that if you have any signs and symptoms and it could just creep up on you, you know, with diabetes, you know, going to the toilet, you feeling thirsty, things that you don't really suspect to be diabetes. You know that 3 to 6 years before the diagnosis, the signs are there. So there is about up to 0.8 millimoles of your sugar levels increase every year. And then one day you wake up, you've reached the threshold to be considered as type 2 diabetes.
Yeah, I was like that actually, because I do a blood test every year. And my HbA1c used to be less than 5.
That's very good.
And every year when I went to do my test, it would go up. It went to a point where it was 5.6 one year. And then the GP that I usually see, and he's like, oh, you know, you're young, you run marathons, you know, you eat according to the guidelines, so you're fine, don't worry, you're not even there yet, you know. So I was like, you know, this doesn't make sense.
Yeah, because you were healthy, you were doing marathons, etc. So it was a sign that the body was telling you that not everything was 100%. Jasmine?
I, on the other hand, was trying to be good to the animals. So I was trying to be more vegan. I would do from, you know, Meatless Mondays, it would extend. So
we used to do that.
In Asia, when it's Meatless Mondays, what you do then is you eat stuff like maybe a banana leaf rice with lots of curry and vegetables. But what we didn't realize was that a lot of the vegetables were actually root vegetables, or it could be even fruit-based curries and pickles, like mango pickles, super delicious. And my liver turned out more fatty than it ever was just after, you know, that episode of trying to just not eat meat. So that satiety wasn't there. And
you
I
were hangry.
Hungry all the time. Hangry, correct.
So many hangry people.
What do you normally eat in your household these days?
So I think there's no one diet that fits one person. There's no one size fits all approach. So what I normally do is I always ask my clients, okay, you know, can you think of your most healthy relative that you actually admire? And so I try to practice what I preach. So I asked my dad, like, what did my 98-year-old great-grandmother eat? And it turns out that she was really big on the Mediterranean diet. So because fish and seafood was cheaper than chicken and beef and everything else, so she had a lot of vegetables, a lot of seafood, and because in those days she had to chop the wood, there was no electric stove. And so there was a lot of physical work, and there was 8 grandkids to look after. So can you imagine the washing of the clothes and all the laundry? So I think for my genetic predisposition, it's about eating, you know, as close to what she ate. Because if I wanted to mimic her health outcomes and to be physically active.
That's amazing. God bless her. What was her name, Therese?
I normally call her Jojo, and because I don't really remember her actual name, but I should ask my dad.
Or her maiden name.
Yeah, I'll have to find out.
Okay, because my grandma this year is turning 104.
Wow.
And when Nikki met her and Nikki's mom, they asked her, what did you eat? And she said, Tau Yu Ba, which is basically the three-layered pork with soy sauce, steeped in soy sauce. But that was sort of like her staple. So I think those days, they really did work hard. There was a lot of non-sedentary lifestyles.
Yeah, I spoke to Jasmine's Jojo, grandmother, not Jojo. She actually told me that they used to buy the, like, the fascia of the pig.
What's a fascia of the pig?
It's like a thin layer of white netting of mammals. And they buy it from the, actually she says she got it free from the butcher. She would bring it back, clean it, and then make mince pork and make it into like spring rolls, wrap it into spring rolls and pan fry them. Nothing is wasted.
I think there's a lot to say with head to tail eating. I think we've lost a big nutrient by not eating offal and just eating the white meat. I had an 89-year-old client, and he lives independently in his one-bedroom unit. And his wife, he visits her in the rest home, you know, most days. And everyone in the rest home is asking him, "No, when's your turn? When are you going to join us?" And he loves his food spicy. So at the veranda of his unit, he's got these styrofoam boxes and he plants chilies. And so he told me he likes his food spicy, and if he goes into care, you know, he'll have to eat non-spicy foods. But I think his secret sauce was that every month he would cook his lamb's fry. So he gave me the recipe. He cooked some bacon, tomatoes, and, you know, onions, and then he would cook it up once a month. And then he would take an Uber and give half to his brother because he couldn't finish it. And he's pretty healthy at 89 years old.
That's pretty cool. For some of our listeners who are listening in from all over the world, what's actually a lamb's fry? Because it's not actually lamb.
So it's the liver of, I think, the lamb? Yeah. Or is it the kidney? I can't remember. It's either one of those. He was telling me.
It's the innards. It's the parts.
Yeah, it's the innards. And the lamb, you know, if it's a kidney, you soak it twice in salt water to remove the smell, and then you pour hot water over it to remove the top layer, and then it's yummy.
That must be the kidney or something, because the kidney's got smell.
Have you had the kidney? You've had the kidney.
I've had kidneys before. When I was growing up, my mother used to cook kidneys all the time and liver, you know, but as an adult, because we were told that, you know, offals are really bad for you, so we stopped eating. But the last couple of years, I've been eating liver and heart and all that. It's really, really tasty, actually.
Yes, if you can prepare it well, it's, you know, it's actually really good. But more important is the nutrients that you get that you can't get from the white meat, so the vitamins A.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Therese, you being a pharmacist, right? There's this big hype about supplementation and vitamins, and you know, people are just popping pills every morning.
Have you got some as well to show and tell?
My father.
Yeah. Okay.
My father is a pill popping supplement. Loads, Therese.
Wow. Yeah. It can be an expensive hobby.
It's very expensive.
Yeah. Okay, wow, you've got tons and tons. Yes. So my take on it, I used to be evidence-based, and all the evidence saying that, okay, if you just take vitamin E, it's going to increase your mortality. If you just take vitamin D, it's going to cause this and that. I think it's a bit more sophisticated, and there's a lot of gaps in the research with supplements. I think it comes down to the timing. So when are we actually taking the supplement, and what are we trying to achieve? So for example, if you were to boost your immune system and you're going to take some zinc, so you want to take it before you get the, you know, the COVID or whatever infection you're trying to prevent. So with supplements, my take is I prefer to get it from a whole food, nutrient-dense diet. But in saying that as well, you know, with the current state of the soil and trying to get sufficient amounts from food itself, and with this modern lifestyle that we have, you know, how can you, you know, guarantee that you're going to get your ADEKs, your fat-soluble vitamins, and all your water-soluble vitamins on a regular basis and in sufficient quantities to actually help, you know, build your immune system and prevent disease. So I've now had more of a think about it. I think with supplements, it needs to be personalized. It needs to be personalized to what the person is trying to achieve. So in my on my website, I've highlighted the three top supplements to boost the immune system. However, I feel that all the vitamins, you know, they're essential, which means that you can't actually make them yourself, and you have to rely on external sources, whether it's diet or supplement. So A is the timing, what you're trying to achieve, the formulation and the strength as well. So there's a lot of controversy with vitamin D. Some say that it helps you know, boost the immune system. Some say it doesn't work at all. And I think our body, these biological pathways are a bit more sophisticated. I think when the studies look at just one element of this, you know, interconnected pathway, we're not getting the full picture. Do we need to add, you know, the D's and the other fat-soluble vitamins together? Because they all bang, 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 like in a factory, when you make a car, you know, you need all the elements. You need the car tires, you need the fan belt, you need the, you know, the steering wheel, etc. And if you haven't got one of the elements, then you don't have a car. You haven't got a functional piece of machinery. And I think our body, you know, is more sophisticated than a car. And so with the supplements, if you're going to take just one on its own or in the wrong strength, you know, it may or may not work depending on your individual diet and environment. So there's a lot of factors to play. It's a bit more sophisticated. For me, when I was on a multivitamin and I had a chronic condition and it didn't do a thing at all. And I read this book called The Perfect Health Diet by Paul Gemini. He's an astrophysicist who did a lot of work into different clinical trials and the amount and quantity of vitamins that you require for healthy function. And I actually adopted, you know, higher strength and personalized it to my diet. And I found that it changed my health. And also in my health coaching business, my clients, they get access to the paid subscription version of the Chronometer app, where they get to actually, you know, add all the different foods they eat. So I can see the micronutrients that they're ingesting and what is lacking. So I think a one-stop size of, you know, just blanket, take this supplement, it's going to, you know, increase your health. When, you know, it's not going to work. But if we personalize it based on the dietary intake of the client, what they're actually, you know, eating, how much A's, D's, EK's and that they're taking, whether they require a top-up in the B's, etc. And that's what I think when the magic will happen. And none of the clinical trials have actually addressed that as yet.
Thanks for that really in-depth sharing, actually. I think as a pharmacist, that's where you come from, you know, because you're dealing with all of this every day. And I'm sure you have all kinds of questions from patients, people who walk through the doors. Currently, are you in that position where you are front-facing, like patients?
Yes. So in Australia, we have a medicines review business where I get referrals from GPs to review patients' medicines to check for side effects and interactions, whether the medications, they interact with one another and affect how they work. I also check for drug nutrients interactions. So if somebody is on a blood pressure pill and there's a high chance that they might be depleting their zinc, or if they're on diuretic, they might be depleting a lot of their salts as well. So being able to actually understand the depletion and matching it with signs and symptoms, because a lot of times the signs and symptoms of low magnesium, could be a tremor, it could be cramps. So a lot of times it's about asking the right questions. So I feel very privileged that I get to actually see patients and review their medications. So I see one end of the spectrum where I look at those with chronic conditions. So most of them are on 5 or more medicines. So they have quite complex cases, and I help the GPs iron out any issues with medicines and help them address any potential side effects or interactions.
That's really awesome, Grace.
Well, I actually have a question about sleep, actually. So sleep being such a taboo subject for a lot of people. Sleep, don't sleep, we don't need so much sleep, we're just too busy to sleep. How many hours of sleep do you think an adult would require? Do you think this sleep thing will play a part in metabolic health?
Yeah, sleep, it's so underrated. When I see my clients, I can gauge the quality of their health just by asking them, what's your sleep like? I think the jury is
telling,
out
huh?
too. It's so telling, because there's so much more science now as this basic function that we require as humans. Who feels refreshed after a good night's rest? So a lot of times, the science, we're still learning the different stages of the sleep cycle. And I think what I normally tell my clients is that there's 5 stages in the sleep cycle. Each one has a different function. And we know that one of the function is to help consolidate memories. So it's like a filing system. So you remember today, tomorrow. So it's important for housekeeping. And then we have more science. It's from animal studies, but it tells us that we can detoxify when we sleep as well. So we're getting rid of the muck. So again, it's another housekeeping element. So we're getting the garbage truck out when we sleep. We're finding our memories, because we know with patients with dementia, if they have less sleep, there's a higher chance that they're going to play up. So I think with the science, the jury is out to how much sleep you require. So Nikki, you've asked me a loaded question. I think it depends on the individual, the activity they go through on a day-to-day basis. The Women's Health study said, 7 hours or more can reduce cardiovascular issues. And I find that 7 hours, which means that if the sleep cycles, it takes 1.5 hours per cycle. So if you get 5 times of that, that's probably sufficient amount to provide that detoxification, that memory filing, that healing, that regeneration. So sleep is so important, because day to day, we spend our days working, studying, that we haven't got time for the housekeeping. So when we sleep, when we get to do the housekeeping, so the next day the body, is reset and you can start again as well. There have been studies which show that sleep restriction, less than 4 hours, can increase weight. So your question about whether it affects metabolic health, we haven't got all the answers now, but I think the signs are coming out that it's important for hormonal balance, that if you don't get enough sleep, you feel more hungry, your ghrelin increases, and so it does impact how we actually eat. And metabolism is how we digest and break down foods for energy. So I think, in the future, we probably get more and more information that tells us how important sleep is.
So actually, the environment plays a big part as well, right? So countries like Asia where 24 hours dining is always available and people are constantly provided with that chance of eating.
100%. The blue light from all the devices is a big problem because it reduces the production of your sleep hormone, melatonin. So it's hard to get sleep because you're always on the device and it emits the blue light. And, you know, the television does the same as well. So I think it's a big problem around the world when we use our devices left, right, and center. And that dopamine hit, once you actually click and, you know, go through your social media, you know, it's hard to stop, right? So there's that to can deal with as well. So I think I always tell my clients 1 to 2 hours before bedtime, you know, avoid the blue light from devices, and then you know have a sleep routine. Then you can, you know, be easy to get to bed.
I remember this very distinguished gentleman that we both met. He was a statesman in Malaysia, and he had a little hidden room in his office where he would go and have a snooze in the middle of the day, and I think he would sleep like for an hour or something like that throughout the day, and then he would just go on. And when we met him, he was already in his 80s and he was still working, and I never forget that story. And I said, if I'm ever there, I will have a little snooze room in my office. And I remember seeing pictures of, I think it was in China or Taiwan, not that they're the same country, just on a political note there, a lot of people think it's the same country, but it's not. They were employees sleeping under desks during lunchtime.
Yeah.
Do you remember seeing that?
Yeah. I know a few friends who work for Chinese company. Even here in Malaysia, they have sleep time.
So during the day?
Yes.
Like lunchtime or something?
Yeah. So it's 15 minutes sleep time. People can sleep underneath the desk or on their desk. Yep.
How even here in Malaysia. Imagine that in Australia.
I'm very impressed that in those Asian countries that they've actually given, you know, a snooze time for their employees. It must be very productive or else they wouldn't be implementing it.
Oh, because people are eating so much carbs, right? They would doze off after lunch.
The postprandial.
That's probably right.
That's fine.
So, Nikki, you think that people are eating too much carbs?
Oh, definitely. Definitely. You've been to Asia before, you know, everything is carbohydrate rich and filled with seed oil.
Is it only in Asia though?
I think it's everywhere, not just Asia.
What do you think, Therese?
I think it's ubiquitous, and I think a lot of times, you know, in Asia you load up with rice. In Western countries, it might be potatoes, all the starchy food, so it's all carbs. So the biggest macronutrient that's being eaten and promoted would be carbs. So if you eat too much of one macronutrient, then you might not have enough protein, which is important for, you know, building your tissues and your antibodies and your immune cells, etc. So it has to be balanced.
It's a filler, isn't it? At the end of the day, a carb is a filler. Just like we were in a supermarket the other day looking for powdered milk, because believe it or not, a carton of Australian imported milk is almost like 20 ringgit or more.
Wow.
20 ringgit or $20?
Ringgit. Here, okay. In Malaysia. We're in Malaysia
about
$4. Right now. 20 ringgit for a carton of milk, that's ridiculous. I mean, your median average lowest wage, the minimum wage in Malaysia is 1,500 ringgit a month. So for a 20 ringgit carton of milk, who's going to be able to afford that? So we went along the milk aisle, it's all the imported milks and the labels. There was really not one label I could find that did not have maltodextrin. And I was quite shocked. So what is maltodextrin? If I could ask from a pharmacist's point of view, is it a good thing or it's harmless?
I think you've hit the nail on the head that, you know, something that's natural, when you actually do things to it and you add you know, fillers or anything else, it changes the whole, the benefits that you, you know, use it for the, you know, for the beginning. So I think when you add more things and it's not natural, that the body, you know, has difficulty in digesting it as well. So when you add maltodextrin, it's a white starchy powder, it's meant to improve flavor, thickness or shelf life. But what does it do to the human?
What is it actually?
It's a carbohydrate, isn't it?
Yes.
Yep. Not quite sure. But I have seen a video that was produced by a Malaysian, I think he was from the Malaysian Trade Export Government Linked Agency. And he was explaining how it was actually harmless. And it was a flavor enhancer. A bit like MSG.
Yes.
But it looks like it's like a bulker, you know, it just adds bulk.
Yes, I'm just having a look at Wikipedia. It says that it's a vegetable starch that's been hydrolyzed. And it says that it's produced from vegetable starch and lots of processing to make it easily digestible. And what it does is that, you know, because it's a carbohydrate, it gets converted to glucose quite fast. And that's when you get the sugar hit. And we know with sugar, it can be addictive. So I suppose with the food industry, it's very attractive to put something in that's going to taste good and increase the sales value as well. But I think for consumers like yourself, who's a bit more on the alert for any additives, you know, would you buy something with maltodextrin, Jasmine?
No, I mean, I spent hours like with my glasses looking at labels, and I finally did find some milk that says full cream milk, and then there was the brand, and it was just, the contents was just milk, solidifier, and
soy
water
isolate.
So I bought that.
So it's fake stuff. Where do you get the real stuff?
Yeah, you can't get the real stuff here.
You gotta come back to where the cows are.
Yeah, because we're all disconnected from the acquisition of food right now, right? So the picture behind you really tells the story that we've been told to eat a certain way because manufacturer are in the position of controlling the food source.
So in Australia and New Zealand, there's farmers markets where you actually meet the producers and you can ask questions. And I think there's accountability and responsibility when farmers and producers, they get asked a question that, you know, they know that consumers care. But when you have the packaged processed stuff, there's a bit of a barrier. So you can't see who produces the food. The care factor and accountability, you know, has shifted.
That's true. Yeah, it becomes desensitized, right? It becomes institutionalized.
Yeah, so you don't know how the animal has been cared for, what they are fed, because there's this whole big curtain, and nobody's drawing the curtain to see how the animal is being looked after, cared for, and you know. So I think when everything's packaged and processed, it's hard to see the wood from the trees.
I remember in America, I was with a friend. In a supermarket, and she would only buy square chicken. They had to be square.
Square chicken.
I thought I would do her a good deed. I cooked her like a fish curry.
Yum.
And I bought the fish with bones in it. She couldn't eat it. She was like, "What? What did you buy?"
I mean, it's a disconnect then. You don't understand how the food was produced or put together, and you don't really know, and you don't, there's lack of awareness. And I think, Nikki, your point, you know, when there's a disconnect, I remember my uncle telling me that they only had chicken, you know, during special occasions. Now you can get chicken all the time, and it's ready made and it's ready packaged. And because it's all available, and you forget that you have to, you know, sacrifice a chicken. You have to chop it up and put it into different sort of like portions, etc. That you forget, you know, what did we do to the chicken? What did we feed it? Did it have a good and healthy life before we actually sacrificed it? And the disconnect, I think, is a problem because you go for instant prepackaged food just because that's what you grew up with.
Yeah, talking about portion, maybe we can discuss weight loss, portion control, and calorie counting.
So as a pharmacist, I do a lot of dietary and lifestyle counseling. So I tell patients, you know, with water and hydration, how it affects their medications. You need the water to transport medication to the right places. You need the enough water to flush out any excess medication so there's less accumulation. So I thought I did my job when I spoke to this client. He only drinks 2 glasses of water on a regular basis. And then when I saw them again the next time, you know, I was told that, oh, he was admitted for kidney failure. So if you haven't got blood water flow, then your kidneys can't work. So I was like, oh my goodness, you know, information itself is not enough. So I thought I owed it to this client of mine. So I sort of, you know, have a look and see, you know, what sort of information or what sort of training can I get to help clients understand not just the information, but, you know, overcome any limiting belief or any blocks that they have. So I came across health coaching, and that's when you actually, you know, assess the why, the limiting beliefs, and you help the client go from point A to point B, addressing all the limiting beliefs that they put together. And that's when, you know, I realized that, okay, all these dietary lifestyle sort of advice, you know, information itself is not enough if we don't address the root cause of the blocks.
So water is a transporter.
Yes. So it has a trans. So if you go and get your bloods done, so you go to the phlebotomist, they find a vein, but then nothing comes out, and they ask you, did you drink any water? And the water is the, you know, it's the missing link that, you know, transports and creates the flow. So if there's no water, the medication is not going to reach you know, where it's meant, the target organ, and also any excess medications will just accumulate, and there's a higher chance of side effects.
Right. What about patients who then go on the other way and drink too much water?
Yes, that happens as well.
How much is too much?
So again, we don't have all the answers. A general rule of thumb, you know, because it depends on where you live, the activity you actually go through, the environment, the temperature. So a general rule of thumb is looking at the color of your urine. So in the morning, you disregard the first one because it's going to be dark from an overnight fast. So after that, you know, you aim for pale yellow or straw color. So it's a general rule of thumb, you know, there's lots of elements and other factors to consider, but generally that's one of the ways I tell my clients. And to answer your question about weight loss, Nikki, so a lot of times as a health professional, you tell patients, oh, you know, we all need to lose a bit of weight, and we need to do this and do that sort of thing, but then it doesn't happen.
Yeah, it doesn't happen.
So with this health coaching course, one of my habits is I'm a chronic chip eater. So once I start eating chips, I can't stop.
Me too. You're a chronic curry puff eater.
Oh, that's true. I would be like that if you could get curry puffs in Australia. But unfortunately, but chips. So I can eat a whole large bag, you know, on its own. And it's not good like for fatty liver disease or anything like that. Because the more fat you eat, and then any excess, you know, goes to the vital organs. So I brought this because when you do the health coaching course, you have to bring your behaviors you want to change. So I brought it to my health coach, my head poncho trainer, and she asked me, so why are you eating all these chips? You know, what do you get out of it? So I said, oh, I think when I grew up, you know, my grandparents, like as a treat, they would give me some chips, and you know, it probably gave me some comfort. And then she said, oh, so it's like a chip hug.
It's so cute.
And I got so mad. I was like, why am I relying on a chip for a hug? And she asked, like, you know, are there any alternatives that you would consider? And I was thinking, oh, there's so many other alternatives, but I don't know why I'm actually eating this chip thing, because the, you know, you're so used to this behavior. And I had to think about it. Like, there's so many other things I could do. I could, you know, ring a friend and have a chat. I could, again, you know, look through some magazines and play my ukulele or something along those lines to get that same level of comfort. And by her asking me those questions, it made me think that I really don't need to rely on the chip for a hug. And, you know, it's not good for my fatty liver disease, and it's not any good, and there are safe alternatives.
I have quite a few friends who are wonderful marathon runners, half marathon, full marathon, ultra marathons. They're really just beating themselves at this game, and they usually would do a carbo load. I also have family members who say to me, oh, I have to have carbs, but it's okay because I run marathons. So what do you say to somebody like that?
Firstly, I'm not an athlete, so disclaimer, I have so much respect for how people can endure 3 to 4 hours running or longer. So I understand why it's being done, this carb loading, because you're trying to convert this carb into glycogen, so you have this slow release sort of energy, because you don't want to be halfway in the run and then collapse, or, you know, go cycling and then find your legs are not moving. And you don't want to, again, you know, convert to using another macronutrient like proteins, you're going to break down muscle. So understandably, you know, athletes do that for a reason. But I think it's about, you know, asking yourself, what are the risks and what's the benefit of, you know, ingesting so much carbs at the one time? You know, is once okay? Like, are we doing it as a professional, you know, career? How often do you need to be doing that? And we know that some athletes, you know, when they do carb loading again and again and again, there's a high chance of being insulin resistant, because once you've actually put so much carb into the system, you know, the body goes on a strike, and then it downregulates. It can't take so much of, you know, the excess sugar. It becomes, you know, the insulin doesn't work. So it can be a really big problem, and, you know, a pathway to diabetes if you're not careful. The other concern.
I feel guilty, because at one time we were organizing events like that, and we would we were once organizing a banana party. Everything was made out of bananas before they started the run, and it was only a 7-kilometer run.
Banana cake, banana curry, banana roti canai, banana everything.
So what you're saying, Tari, then, is that excess cannot find a way out, is that right?
Well, we're relying on just one macronutrient, and, you know, are we, if to break down the carbs properly, we need all sorts of vitamins as cofactors in the biological pathway. Are they getting enough B5 pentatonic acid to actually help with the breakdown of the carbohydrate? So just relying on, you know, if we know the pitfalls of too much carb in the body, you know, what are you doing to actually rebalance the body? Because the body likes everything in balance. So I think it's about asking, you know, the person, like, what are they trying to achieve? The risk-benefit analysis, you know, what are their goals like long-term? Is this sustainable? And if it's not sustainable, you know, what are the options to manage, like, you know, the excess carbohydrates? You know, can they take other macronutrients? Do they need micronutrients, which are vitamins and minerals that our body cannot produce, so that we can help the process of digestion? It's about being clear on what you're trying to achieve by stuffing, you know, the body with so much carbs. You know, for a fun run, you know, do you really need to actually increase this carbohydrate extravaganza? Or is it just for, like, you know, it's a one-off thing? And if you're doing a one-off thing, that you're actually taking, you know, a lot of measures to balance the risks by making sure that you've got the micronutrients that's necessary to break down the carbohydrates, and then you also checking and monitoring your sugar levels and your HbA1c, all the markers that, you know, point towards type 2 diabetes. I think it's about being aware of the risks and taking, you know, steps to balance the body and to reduce the risk.
I hear balance as the key word here, and that everybody needs a pharmacist friend. Pharmacist Edit, I love the name. How did you come up with it?
So I actually like fashion, and whenever you go and flip through those magazines, they have like the lifestyle edit, and then they show you what's hot in the you know, in the market, and so you sort of, oh look, there's this new thing, you know, that's available that I never heard of. They put it on that page, and so I thought, oh, I could be the pharmacist edit. I could be the knowledge navigator and put like what's out there, you know, that could be beneficial for health.
Oh, that's wonderful. And you've got your own podcast.
Yes. So I've got the pharmacist edit, and my aim is to, you know, get guests who have transformed their own health or their clients so that we can learn from them and, you know, get tips from them on how to actually, you know, have peak performance, because health means everything. If you haven't got health, you know,
absolutely,
how are you gonna, what are you gonna do with your wealth?
Yeah. No health to spend your wealth on.
Well, we being at Asia Fitness today, we advocate for being fit for good, using our fitness for good. We advocate movement as a therapy, actually. So what we see is that food is actually medicine. As much as exercise and movement can bring positive effect, maybe you can share a little bit about your own fitness regime, Tareen.
So for me, because I see so many complications, I've had patients who've had knee replacements, I've had patients who've had mobility issues, and you know, I've seen the complications, and even my own family with knee replacements. So I am very, very sort of motivated because of my genetic predisposition as well to, you know, improve my movement and prevent, you know, any need for any knee or hip replacements in the future. So I actually engaged an exercise physiologist. So my exercise physiologist is amazing. He sets some exercises for me that I can do in my own home. So I have a TRX, which is resistance training.
Right.
So I do strength training 3 times a week. And he got me a program, and I've got a rower to help with my cardio, and because with the rower it exercises all the different muscles, as you know, Nikki. And then I go for a walk like after lunch and dinner, because there's a New Zealand study we showed. They
yes.
compare people who add like and then they check their sugar levels you know, after 30 minutes of exercise versus exercise 10 minutes for 10 minutes after eating. And I found that if you actually exercise for 10 minutes after eating, that regulates and stabilizes the sugar levels. So my husband and I, you know, we go for a walk after lunch and after dinner, and we go for a long walk in the
what a luxury.
Yeah.
Everyone should have that luxury.
You can either take a nap or you can take a walk. Nap underneath your desk or go for a walk.
I think that's a great idea. We should boot that. That should be the norm. I mean, if we're all working from home, right? We're all in our cubby desk at home, go for a walk, come back for a 10-minute snooze.
I don't think you would want to snooze after that because you would be quite energized.
I like this new way that we're moving forward from the 9 to 5. So the whole world has now kind of reset. You know, it is the great reset. And let's hope that we are going towards a better future, a healthier future, a more label-reading aware future. Would you have any other words that you'd like to share with our listeners from the Kurang Manis podcast? What can they do to Kurang Manis?
I think prevention is a very difficult sell for health professionals. And I think my message out there to the audience is that if you have any family history of any health conditions, if you have any signs and symptoms, I think it's important to listen to the body, because sometimes the body can be very talkative and you just have to, again, listen to it. And sometimes it's a bit scary. You don't want to know what you don't want to know. But there is hope out there, like with type 2 diabetes. it's a disease that, you know, it's insidious, it creeps up on you. But if you actually act now, you can actually, you know, prevent the progression. And Professor Roy Taylor, when he looked at his cohort of patients, you know, up to 6 years, you know, with diabetes, you can actually do something, because when you actually lose weight, you're giving permission to your pancreas to reactivate. Because when you actually have got too much fat in the pancreas, it deactivates. And when you actually, you know, lose the fat, you tell your pancreas, welcome back. You know, I want you back in my, you know, at work. And if you do that early enough, you know, you can make a difference to your health.
I just imagine the pancreas doing that song, I want you back. I like the way you're describing our organs, three. It really just humanizes everything and makes it very easy to understand. So how can people reach out to you if they want to know more?
So I really would like to help people who are motivated, who've got skin in the game. So I'm happy to actually offer a virtual coffee to people who come to my website and they want to have a discussion, just a casual discussion, no strings attached. Tell me about where they're coming from, what their health issues are, and see whether we can actually have a working relationship.
So Therese, what's your website?
It's www.pharmacistedit.com.
Oh, that's easy to remember. So your impact work in spreading awareness about chronic diseases through your podcast, through your website, and through your work, really commendable. And we really, really wish you all the best moving forward. One last question before we go. And this is for my own sake and for my mom's sake, because my GP has said to me, if I don't lose weight, she's going to have to prescribe some metformins for me. And I don't want no metformins, not even if they're made in Puerto Rico. That's what it says in the label. The metformins made in Puerto Rico. I'd rather go to Puerto Rico, but I don't want metformin from Puerto Rico, you know, if you know what I mean. So the question is, is type 2 diabetes truly reversible?
Yes, it is. We have a proof of concept from the Diabetes Prevention Program that diet and lifestyle, 58% reduction in the incidence of diabetes versus metformin. So 58 versus 31%. And Professor Roy Taylor's work, if you actually lose 15 kilograms, and I've seen studies which say, you know, 5 to 10% of your weight, then your markers can actually reduce. And because you're incorporating diet and lifestyle, it's something that's sustainable and addresses the root cause of the problem.
That's the best silver lining in any cloud. Thank you so much, Therese. Therese,
it's a pleasure.
Everybody, thank you so much for your time.